May the words of my mouth and the meditations of my heart be acceptable in your sight, O Lord. Casablanca, May 1942. A young French woman, dressed in her preferred, ill-fitting, cigarette-pocked clothes, perches on a stool. She is writing concentratedly in her notebook. In the chaos and the heat of a refugee camp, the bespectacled academic scribbles down thoughts on mathematics, philosophy, and God. The 33-year-old woman is Simone Weil, and like most of her Jewish academic colleagues, she has picked up a handful of books and a few clothes and joined the crowded refugee trails of Europe. In the space of 2 years, she will move from Paris to Marseille, to Casablanca, to New York, and finally to London. In Casablanca, she is trying to tie together the thoughts of her rather unconventional life. She is not quite like most of her other academic colleagues. Driven by an overwhelming hunger for a just society and radical, even to some extreme, acts of personal solidarity, she combines her daytime academic teaching job with teaching Plato to French workers by night, and eventually gives up her academic job to take a frontline job in a car factory so that she can understand for herself the brutal impact of industrial work on the body and the soul. Book knowledge, she thought, taught you only so much about the human condition. There were truths learned only in encounter with the invisible, the suffering, the uprooted, and the rejected. Those who live subject to the iron laws of the world, but rarely get to write about them, and whose truths often make others wish to know a little less. She came to believe during that decade certain basic things: that suffering could not be completely explained or understood. It could only be engaged and transformed. And that transformation happened through a simple mechanism: the gift of pure attention given freely by one human person to another who suffers. She thought this the truest and most precious gift that any human being could give to another, and she thought it uniquely difficult to do. She believed that all education was a training in this attention, how to give it and how to receive it. She believed that physics and maths trains us in how to pay deep attention just as much as literature or theology. Learning for her should be a seamless whole. But all these studies are mere preparation for her for the greater task of human attention: how to raise the suffering back to life, how to make the invisible visible to themselves and to others. The last words that she would write in her notebooks were, "The most important part of education, - to teach the meaning of to know." But on her stool in Casablanca, she is also writing about what happened to her in the gloom of an Italian church 5 years earlier. Assisi, 1937. Simone Weil falls to her knees in prayer in a church. This has never happened to her before. She is a rational academic and a social activist. She struggles with the concept of God. There is surely, she thinks, truth in the religions of East and West, in philosophy, in numbers and physics. She tells herself that religious people tend towards unattractive, excessive fervor. They tend sometimes to justify violence in the name of their sacred texts, which, she added, they often become oddly bad readers of. So she hovers without commitment. Yet here she is, inexplicably on her knees. Solesmes, Benedictine Abbey, France, 1938. She once again experiences this same inexplicable deep peace. This time, it is the austere monastic plain chant of the monks that brings her to her knees. She's overwhelmed not by fervor, but by beauty and simplicity and peace. Something that she says is close to pure joy. She writes in her notebook after this experience, "I have held the theory that joy is an indispensable ingredient in human life for the health of the mind. To live without access to joy is the equivalent of madness." In the Abbey, she meets a young Englishman who reads her George Herbert's poem, "Love Bade Me Welcome." She learns it off by heart, and whenever her terrible migraines hit, she recites it over the pain. She laughs at herself. Stuck on the idea of God, it had not occurred to her that Christ himself would reach out and touch her body and soul and mind. The poem captivated her because Christ speaks directly to the soul who feels themselves unworthy. And she has been gripped all her life by a crippling sense that she is unworthy and inadequate. This God who is love touches that pain, bids her welcome, and gifts her peace and joy. In the past, she has mainly lived with a sense of the gravity or the weight of things. Now she sees how grace and gravity work together. God is not an escape route. God is how we come to dwell more deeply in the sheer difficulty of things, but with love. God is how we get as deeply into the world as possible. She writes, "The tree is really rooted in the sky." And her route to this knowledge had been through a deep sense of God's absence, which now turned to a deep longing. And prayer for her became the way to train attention. She pours all of these thoughts into her notebooks, and she reads the parable of the Good Samaritan. She writes that for her it is the story of a miracle, the miracle of attention given and received. When one human truly loves another, wishes their good even above their own, this is a miracle. We do not do it naturally. We do not find it easy to be drawn into the suffering of others, she writes, because it costs us. And the suffering person does not always find it easy to receive the kindness of another. Human beings do not always like their vulnerability or their need for the healing attention of others. She notes, the wounded man never says thank you in Luke's gospel. He says, in fact, in the Good Samaritan passage, precisely nothing. To truly be moved for deep care of another human is akin to a miracle. It is what God makes possible in us. Notting Hill, London, 1943. She is still writing to her beloved parents. Out of love, she lies to them. She tells them she's in love with London, its trees and its people. She does not tell them that she is in poor health. She does tell them that she has this overwhelming fear that her life will amount to very little. In better news, she tells them that she's seen Shakespeare's King Lear. How stupid am I, she writes, to realize its message so late. There is a class of people who have fallen into the lowest degree of humiliation, she writes, who are deprived of every social consideration, who appear to society without dignity or reason. These are the people, in fact, who are able to tell the truth. All the others lie, she writes. or at least they squirm to avoid the truth. Because the fools in Lear possess no academic titles or episcopal dignitaries, no one is aware that what they have to say deserves any attention, but they continue to tell the truth and their lives reveal it to those with eyes to see. Ashford, Kent, 1943. There is no more writing. She has tuberculosis. She cannot get well because she will eat only the rations available to the suffering French. Her heart gives up, and the doctor, knowing nothing of her choices to live in total solidarity with others out of love, records cruelly that her death was suicide. It is truer to say that her frail body could not bear the marathon-like commitments of her soul. After the war has taken the last of its dead, her notebooks are transcribed painstakingly by her parents, and her life comes to seem anything but futile. Her gift was to draw us unflinchingly towards love and towards the source that sustains and gifts that love without end. Love bade me welcome, yet my soul drew back, guilty of dust and sin. But quick-eyed love, observing me grow slack from my first entrance in, drew nearer to me, sweetly questioning if I lacked anything. A guest, I answered, worthy to be here. Love said, you shall be he.